Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with writer M.A. Harper, whose new novel is Diamonds in the Sky, and her publisher, Julie Smith, about ebook publishing. We'll also hear from Bill Cotter, author of The Parallel Apartments, who's coming to New Orleans for the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. It's so much fun to welcome my next guest to The Reading Life. Annette Harper is a New Orleans novelist who writes as M.A. Harper. She made waves with her first novel, For the Love of Robert E. Lee, and then with her other books, The Worst Day of My Life So Far, one of the all-time great titles, and The Year of Past Things. Her new book, Diamonds in the Sky, is coming out as an e-book. Julie Smith is a longtime New Orleans mystery writer and Edgar Award winner for New Orleans Morning. She has turned to publishing with her own publishing company, BooksBeNimble.com. Author and publisher, we're happy to have you both with us today. Julie, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
You it's too, nice Annette. To be
back. Thank you.
Now, Annette, I remember when we ran into each other quite some time ago, I asked you what you were working on now. And you said a novel about bright and shiny things.
That's right. That's right.
So tell us about how that plays into this book.
Well, the book is basically about a woman living her life in one place and an elderly man living his life in another place. And the failed writer that sort of gets them joined up together. It's a coincidence. There are lots of coincidences in this book. For people who can't take coincidences, this is not the book for you. But she dreams about diamonds falling from a UFO. And the next day she finds a diamond, or what might be a diamond, in the middle of Magazine Street in New Orleans. Meanwhile, the elderly farmer in another place, in another state, everybody in his neighborhood sees UFOs one night except for him. He says he slept through it. He doesn't know anything about it. The third character, the writer who eventually hooks these people up together and gets involved in their lives, he's unclear on everything. He's somebody without any kind of anchor whatsoever. But he likes shiny things, he thinks. Certainly women. Shiny women work great for him. And artwork. He comes to the artist because of her artwork, and everybody sort of meets one another, and I'm not going to give away the ending, but I don't like sad endings, let's say that.
It's a very satisfying ending, let's say that. How
good,
about that?
Good.
Now, this is the second novel I've read in a week about a person who makes collages. What is it that drew you to that as an art form for your person?
Well, because I've made some. I majored in fine arts at Newcomb College. I wasn't supposed to be a writer. Never took anything creative writing classes or anything. But over the years, I started making collages, and I've made a bunch. And I guess it's just the opportunity to put things together. And you do it without plan, or I do it without plan. Putting them together surprises you. You end up with a vision that is bigger than the sum of its parts. And the surprise is what I like. I couldn't plan these things if I wanted to, but once they're done, and I've got like a king cake baby mixed up with some gold foil, mixed up with postage stamps, mixed up with wire, and the whole thing is a very cool looking thing. It's delightful. It just simply delights me. So I don't know about other artists, or since I'm not technically an artist, I don't know about collagists, if that's even the word, but I love shiny things myself.
So. Me too. It sounds like you could have a great career in making Muses shoes, you know? Just
well, yes.
I think it'd be fun.
Probably.
I also think it's such a great metaphor for making sense of the world. this kind of random assemblage of things that strike your fancy and appeal to your aesthetic sense. It's very satisfying, I think. You should bring some of your collages around and show them off. So you've had this long and good career in traditional publishing. So what made you turn to an ebook for this version? How did you connect with Julie?
Well, failure.
Oh.
Failure. When this book was finished, the editor that I'd been working with at Harcourt for years, she was left behind because she was on the West Coast in the San Diego offices, and she didn't want to leave San Diego. So when they closed those offices, she was out of work. The new editor in New York didn't like this book. So Harcourt didn't want it, and they passed it off to a young agent named Paula Balzer. And Paula read it and thought she could rep it, and then she felt broke and she left agenting. And so the book was simply on a shelf. An old acquaintance, Susan Davis in Charleston, South Carolina, who used to have Chapter 2 books in Charleston, knew about the book. She wanted to read it. I sent the book to her. She loved it. She didn't know how to place it. She had Cassandra King and Carl Leonard's both look at it. Never heard from Cassandra King, but Carl Leonard sent it to several different agents, all of which turned it down. And the book was just orphaned. It was an utter failure. And, you know, I felt bummed. I had a day job. I still do. So I could eat, but I felt really bummed. And mentioned it at the store to Chris Wiltz, local author, noted, wonderful local author. And she told me she was getting into ebooks, that she was tired of playing the game with publishers. And she put me in touch with Julie Smith, and the rest is history. It's wonderful. I mean, I feel like that the book is a better book than it would have been, I think, if it had come out in print, because I think Julie Smith is a much better editor than the editor at Harcourt who just didn't like it. I think even if that woman had taken it on, it would have been an inferior book to what it is today. So if stars and diamonds from the sky can guide people into where they need to be, and if life itself is sort of a collage, then Books Be Nimble is where I need to be. And I've been led there, and I'm very happy.
Now, you know, this is not an uncommon thing for writers now to have had a long and established career and then kind of hit this brick wall where it seems like everybody you know in publishing has been swept up by the rapture or something. You know what I mean? Mm. So, Julie, you've always been very receptive and supportive of New Orleans writers. So what drove you to start Books Be Nimble? And when did you start?
Started about 3 years ago, and I think mostly I just thought it was a great opportunity in publishing because, as you point out, everyone's been swept up by the rapture that you know, and it seemed as if things were changing so rapidly and not in a particularly good way for print. It seemed as if it was ebooks were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and in those days, think what the difference is from 3 years ago. It was just really beginning. So it fascinated me. And I felt that publishing as we know it was not responding to it fast enough. And that's why we named it Books Be Nimble.
Books Be Nimble, Books Be Quick.
Yeah.
So how did you gain your expertise in this new area?
Really a good question. I'm gaining it every day, little by little, second by second. It's a rapidly, rapidly changing business, and the learning curve is gigantic. So, and there are no courses. Actually, there may be starting to be courses now, but you have to learn it yourself. And so there's a lot of books about it that people who've done it have written. There are many, many, many blogs. And then there's trial and error, which is my favorite.
It's worked for me a lot in the past. I know what you mean. So you've done some amazing things with video as well with your Books Be Nimble products. I know, I hate to call them products. Books. So tell us about, for example, the trailer you have up right now for Tony Dunbar's Tubby Dubonnet series, which I think a lot of New Orleans readers will be happy to hear. They can get his ebooks.
Kind of you to say that you like them, Susan. We start out as an enhanced ebook publisher. Our idea was to have videos in every single book. I was so excited about the different ways that ebooks could go, but it turns out that mostly people prefer just a straightforward book. But in the meanwhile, we had made some really fun videos. And what Tony did, I don't know if everybody knows who we're talking about, Tony Dunbar is the author of the Tubby Dubonnet series, which is a wonderful detective series, both funny and noir at the same time. So I asked Tony to come up with something that he felt fit the series. And so he did Tubby Dubonnet's New Orleans. Actually, Tony, not Tubby, goes to some dive bars and and more respectable places. And I think it is quite a fun one. Thank you for saying that.
Has his humor all over it. So, Annette, how does it feel for you to be published in this way? Does it feel different in any way? Do you miss not having the book in your hand? How do you feel about that?
I'm getting used to it. I guess because my previous novel, The Year of Past Things, was taken up by Juliet Books Be Nimble and brought out as an ebook. It was retitled. It's now called Ghost in the Bedroom. And I really liked what was done with it. I liked the idea that you could retitle it. I've never been able to title my own books. For the Love of Robert E. Lee was not a title I picked out. I feel like my liberal friends have to read that thing with a plain brown wrapper on it.
Oh, it's a great title.
That was not my title. Worst Day of My Life So Far. That was a good title. That was not my title. She did a good job. But retitling this book and bringing it out in a different way got me used to ebooks. And so the idea that this one would come out exclusively as an ebook, I was sort of used to it. And I don't really feel like I need to have a book in my hand to feel like it's a book. And yet 2 years ago, I would have definitely said yes. But it's all worked out.
Yeah. Now, Julie, how do you feel? I mean, your prowess as an editor is legendary. I've heard so many writers talk about how much you've helped them with their work. How do you feel about this new role of ushering books into the world? I mean, what for you is the moment when a book is published, for example? What's that like?
I love the role of ushering books into the world, and I love working with a writer like Annette, who's actually so easy to work with, you would not believe. But to work together with the writer and help to shape the book is really a very rewarding thing. But the moment of publication, it's just like a print book. It's when you look on Amazon and there's your book. Mm. You know, you can't touch it, but it really looks good.
It's a space saver, that's all I can say. Oh, we've been talking with Annette Harper, who is M.A. Harper, is the author of Diamonds in the Sky, and Julie Smith, who's the publisher of Books Be Nimble. You can find out more about the book and Books Be Nimble at booksbenimble.com. That's books, the letter B, nimble.com. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Bill Cotter is a Texan, born in Dallas, now living in Austin, but from his novels, you'd swear he had a New Orleans sensibility. His first novel, Fever Chart, took place partly in the Crescent City, and his just published book, The Parallel Apartments, moves back and forth between New Orleans, Austin, and a town called Texas City. Bill has a fascinating background, including a career in book restoration, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him about his time in New Orleans. Bill Cotter will be one of the featured authors at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Welcome to The Reading Life, Bill.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So tell me about your time in New Orleans in the mid-90s. You had some interesting jobs here, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I don't know if you remember back when, but there was the Harris Casino. I think there's still one there now. Am I right?
Oh, yes.
Kind of a canal or something?
Uh-huh.
But back in the 90s, there was the Proto Casino. There was kind of a test casino at the Louis Armstrong Hall. Is that what it's called? I'm not sure if it's even there anymore. It was in Treme. And it was just a converted building, a music hall, converted into this casino. And that's where I worked as an impressment specialist, which is someone that simply brings coins from the counting room, those fake coins, those slot machine coins,
right,
and brings them to the slot machines, jams them in underneath, and then goes and collects the money once it's been put in and takes it back to the count room where it is counted by these large machines. And that's called an impressment specialist, and that was my job at Harrah's.
So what got you to New Orleans in the first place?
It was kind of an escape. I was living in Western Massachusetts. I'd spent some bad years in New England and was very unhappy there for most of that time, and decided that one day I just needed to make a change. And my sister Karen lived in New Orleans at the time, and she says, well, why don't you come down here? And So I did. I got a U-Haul and brought my books and moved down there. This was in the mid, I guess, 94, 95 maybe.
I love the way you say brought my books.
Yeah, I got my books.
That's what I would take with me, of course.
I think that's pretty much all I took.
Oh, and you have this story about finding a book in Dauphine Street Books that set you on a different kind of course.
Yes, that's right. I was poking around in Dauphine Street Books. Is that still there?
Yes.
Is it? Okay, great. I'm glad to hear that. I loved that place when I lived there. And yeah, I was poking around in Dauphine Street Books, looking at their very rare and valuable books in this glass case, and just desperately wishing that I could have one of those. I think one of them was James Joyce's Poems Penny Each, little bitty book, and I really coveted that. But I turned away from the case of books that I could not afford and started poking around in the books on books section, because I'm also a book collector. And if I can't have the books that I want, at least I can read about them. So I was poking around in that section and came across a book on bookbinding. And it was an instructional manual. I remember the author's name even, Manly Bannister. not an easily forgettable name.
Nope.
And so I bought that book, a few bucks, and brought it home, and that turned into a hobby for me, which ultimately turned into a business. I became a rare book restorer. I didn't actually go into business until I had moved to Austin some years later, and I still do a little bit of that today.
And you chronicled your bankruptcy in that business for McSweeney's, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
That was an episode.
That was a saga. I mean, it really was. Well, you've talked about the five disciplines of books: reading, collecting, writing, restoring, and selling. And so you're sort of done it all now. So talk about turning to writing and the inspiration you found in New Orleans for your books.
Well, you know what? I wasn't really inclined to write when I lived in New Orleans. I didn't have an urge to do it. I didn't really feel like that was something I wanted to do, and had not grown up with an urge to write. A lot of people say, you know, oh yeah, I started writing when I was seven, wrote fairy tales and that sort of thing, and it just developed into writing as a career. That didn't happen to me. I didn't even discover that I liked to write or that I was competent at it until I was in my mid-30s. I was reading Grimm's Fairy Tales at the time. This is probably, 15 years ago, I guess. And I just loved Grimm's fairy tales. They were so strange. They didn't make any sense. The endings were ridiculous, and they were just so bloody. It seemed like something that would be fun to parody, to lampoon, to send up. And so I wrote one for my girlfriend as a Valentine's Day present, and it was about a cork maker. Now, there's no such thing as a cork maker, which I thought was the perfect absurdity. and he has a goiter that can tell the future. That seemed like the kind of thing that Grimm's fairy tales did. I wrote this. And it came out really well. I thought it was funny and obviously a parody. But I really enjoyed doing it. I loved writing it. It was so much fun. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do this. So I wrote a few more fairy tales and then started writing stories. And that ultimately turned into a novel. And the subject matter of New Orleans seemed the most immediate and obvious thing to write about, since that was, I think, my trip to New Orleans, moving to New Orleans, was the most drastic and memorable change in my life.
It's a transformational place for a lot of writers. It really is.
It is. Don't you think so?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I have to ask, how did the goiter go over as a Valentine?
She was delighted, believe
me. Oh, good.
Yeah.
You never know sometimes.
No, you never know. She has that kind of sense of humor. This is Annie Lagonga. She's a fantastic poet and storyteller. And if you knew her, you would see that she would appreciate that right away. And I was happy she did.
Oh, that's great. Now, there are a lot of fascinating women in the parallel apartments. And chief among them is Justine Moppet. So I wish you'd kind of place her for us. Tell us what she's like.
Justine, she doesn't know what she's doing with her life. And she's somewhat passive. She doesn't really act. She is acted upon. And she's the protagonist of the book. And if you read about the technique of the novel or how you should write a novel. The protagonist should be active and should be doing things and should be changing their life. But Justine is not one of those, so I don't know if I may have failed in that way. She is more passive. It's interesting the way she came about is, okay, I live in Austin. I was driving through the Hyde Park neighborhood, which is where I live. It's a little bit north of the university here. Mm-hmm. And I was with my mother. I was driving down one of the little quiet streets, and she pulled over to the side, to the curb, and pointed to a duplex across the street. And it was just a very ordinary-looking place. It had a wooden fence around it, and there were some of these artisanal chickens poking around in the dirt. Nothing interesting about it, really. And she pointed to it and said, "Bill, that's where you were conceived." And I said, "Oh, I was a little shocked because my mother doesn't refer to anything that could bring to mind the sexual act." And so I was very shocked to hear this from my mother. But what it did was it gave me an immediate idea of someone that is going back to not their place of birth, but their place of conception, hoping to look for answers to old mysteries in their life. And Justine just came out of that.
And she had, at one point, I do kind of love this, the New Orleans dreams. This is what you've written, of course. Justine had always wanted to go and become a genius waitress and learn how to make perfumes like Priscilla and Jitterbug Perfume, or go to the movies all the time like Binks and the Moviegoer, or sell Lucky Dogs in the French Quarter and then commit suicide and get a posthumous Pulitzer Prize like John Kennedy Toole. I know, that's many a person's dream here. You know?
Oh, sure.
Oh, well, and it's such an amazing saga of all these mothers and daughters through time. I mean, writing about women is obviously a lot of fun for you.
Well, you know, I have to admit that I don't know and still don't know how that's going to go off. It's really kind of an arrogance for a man to write about women. I don't know if that's, I mean, of course, men have written about women and women about men, but somehow I'm writing about this entire family, this entire matriarchy, five generations. There's the matriarch, her daughter, her daughter, her daughter, and her daughter. Mm-hmm. And writing about them not only as women, but as mothers, as pregnant women. I don't know why I did that, but I just really, I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by matriarchies. I kind of come from one. My mother is one of four sisters. I have two sisters. There's just many. And I have two, my grandmothers who are dead now, but they were very, very powerful matriarchs in their own way. And that family dynamic has always fascinated me, and I thought I wanted to write about it.
Well, it fascinates the reader, too. And you also seem to be really attracted to the long picaresque novel, to characters who are just setting out to discover the world. How appealing is that to you? These are long, involved books, which is kind of satisfying for a reader. Once you settle in, you're just there for a while.
Oh, glad to hear that. That's my goal anyway. And I do like the picaresque. I like episodic, kind of absurd journeys of self-discovery. And I hope that the first book, Fever Chart, that the protagonist would follow in that vein. And I really hope that Justine in the second book would do the same thing. I don't know if I exactly succeeded or not, but that was what I was hoping. I like adventures. I like episodic adventures that don't really have necessarily a purpose except to learn more about the character.
Right. Well, there are a lot of adventures in the Parallel Apartments. We've been talking with Bill Cotter, author of Fever Chart and the Parallel Apartments. You can meet him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival when he speaks on a panel called Choose Your Own Misadventure, Sunday, March 23rd at 1 p.m. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
People underestimate the romance to be found in bookstores and libraries, but not John Common. In the Bookstore is a wonderful song about just such a romantic refuge.
I don't mean to be the one to keep you from your bookish fun, but I might be that guy today. It's difficult to act cool when you feel this way. The way you twirl your curly hair and bite your lip when people stare, it crushes me beyond belief to know the center of attention wants to be alone. Like a romance novel.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? Lincoln Payne discusses and signs The Sea and Civilization, Tuesday, February 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner, Tuesday, March 4th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Anne Benoit discusses and signs New Orleans Best Ethnic Restaurants, Thursday, March 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Argyle Wolf Knapp and Jeremy Labadie discuss and sign New Orleans Beer, A Happy History of Big Easy Brewing, Saturday, March 8th from noon to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Bonnie Warren and Cheryl Gerber sign New Orleans Historic Homes, Saturday, March 8th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. There will be a poetry reading Saturday, March 8th at 2 at Ladder Library featuring Peter Cooley, Gina Ferrara, State Poet Laureate Ava Lavelle Heyman, and Melinda Palacio. New Orleans Pelicans guard Eric Gordon reads from his favorite children's book, J is for Jump Shot, Saturday, March 8th at 3:30 at the Main Library. That's part of the 30 Events in 30 Days literacy campaign. And coming up, the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is only a month away. Check out tennesseewilliams.net for the complete schedule. But look for these authors with new books who'll be coming to town. Hilton Alls, author of White Girls. Richard Campanella, author of Bourbon Street. Laura Lippman, author of After I'm Gone. Valerie Martin, author of The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. Blake Bailey, author of The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. And today's guest, Bill Cotter, author of The Parallel Apartments. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶